Thank you, Brian. Good morning, everyone. We have a good crowd this morning. We are blessed with a number of visitors. And as always, we are deeply honored by the presence of those of you who have chosen to come spend time with us this morning in our study of God's Word and our worship to Him. We realize there are so many other places that you could be, other things that you could be doing this morning, but the fact that you have chosen your time this morning to be with us, we consider to be just a great honor, and we're very pleased to have you with us and hope that you benefit from this time together with us. About a year ago, I preached a sermon based on this passage that Brian read in your hearing a moment ago, in Deuteronomy chapter 8. In particular, the statement that's found in verse 2, that God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you to know what was in your heart. I had mercy on Brian and did not have him read the rest of that chapter, but if you'll look in your order of service handout, later on in that same chapter in verse 16, he repeats that thought. He speaks of God humbling you that he might test you to do you good in the end. And if you were here at that time and when we were looking at this passage and this concept of God testing us, you'll recall that there were three things that we noticed that every test involves. And if, in fact, life is a test for us, then we can see these same three elements at work in our lives. Number one, every test that God places upon us is a revelation. That is, it reveals the quality and character of what is on the inside. We learn something about ourselves that we didn't know before through the test that God places upon us. And we also noted that every test involves a challenge. There's got to be some way of providing some kind of a stress or a hardship or a pressure upon us in order to reveal what that character or quality is. Without any kind of a challenge, there's really not much of a test, and we don't really learn much about ourselves. But then the third thing that we noticed in that prior study is that every test involves some kind of objective or purpose. There's an end result for which the test is being applied. And in the life tests that we undergo, as we just noted in these passages in Deuteronomy 8, God spelled out why he was testing the Israelites, and that was to humble them and ultimately to do them good in the end. They were better people because of what they went through in experiencing these tests. And this was just the broad brush approach that we took to this subject in that earlier sermon. But since that time, I've been spending quite a bit of time and thought just delving deeper into this concept of life being a test and what this involves. And what I'd like to do today is to pick up from that point a year ago and carry this further in a somewhat different direction. And what I'd like for us to notice is that, in fact, two things. Number one, each one of us has in our life an idol of some kind. Now, for some of us, it may be multiple idols. But there is something that we've erected in our life that has the very real danger of serving as an idol that keeps us from God. And the second point is that God tests us to challenge that idol or those idols that threaten our relationship with Him. I'm just going to lay these two thoughts out as a proposition, and that's what we're going to be exploring this morning. I'd like for us to consider five areas of life in which there are good things that, in fact, have come from God in many cases, but these good things can become a substitute for God. We're going to notice how God can use events in those areas of our lives to, in fact, test our loyalty to Him. So we're going to be looking at five things now that you should be able to immediately recognize in your life. And what I'd like for us to do this morning is to look deep within ourselves and recognize, is this good thing that God has blessed me with, is it in danger of becoming, or is it already an idol in my life? And more than that, what's the challenge? What is the test that God can place upon me in that area of life that really causes me to wrestle with the question of, is this thing more important in my life than God, or is God more important? That's the test that every one of us has to wrestle with. So let's plunge into these five areas and notice how they play out. The first thing I'd like for us to notice is in the matter of our relationships. You're familiar with the story of Abraham and Isaac. How for all those years, God had promised Abraham that he would bless him with a son through his wife Sarah. For 25 long years, Abraham, already an old man, clung to this promise that God was going to give him his own son. And finally, when Abraham was 100 years old, God delivered on his word and gave him little Isaac. And we can just imagine how Abraham, the proud father, doted on his son. Isaac was the long last fulfillment of this promise that God had given to him. In fact, God had told him not just that Isaac was going to be given to him as his own son, but that in fact through Isaac, God would make of Abraham a great nation, and finally all the nations of the earth would be blessed through this boy. All of Abraham's hopes and aspirations and dreams were wrapped up in little Isaac until in chapter 22 of Genesis, God comes to Abraham and says, "Now take him up on Mount Moriah and offer him up to me as a burnt offering." You can just imagine how that command struck Abraham's heart like a dagger. "You've given me all these promises, Lord, about this boy, and now you're telling me to offer him up?" The important thing I'd like for us to consider is how this is introduced in the text. In Genesis 22 and verse 4, God tested Abraham. This was a test on Abraham's part to determine, for him to determine, who's now more important in my life? Is it God, or is it this boy Isaac that God has given me? You see, a relationship now threatens to come between Abraham and God. And what God is doing here in giving this command to Abraham is applying a test with regard specifically to a relationship in Abraham's life. And there's a similar challenge that faces every one of us today. A very common problem that all of us deal with in our lives is that we have people that we are very close to. It may be a parent, it may be a child, it may be a sibling, it may be a spouse. In some cases, it may be a boyfriend or a girlfriend or whatever. You just fill in the blank in your own life and think of all the personal relationships that you have in your life and just pick out one of them as being the most important. And ask yourself, is this person more important in my life than God? And that is the question that we have to wrestle with. Is it possible that there is a relationship in this life that has become more central to my life than God has? The problem, of course, is that if any one person becomes my ultimate purpose in life, my whole life revolves around this individual, whoever it might be, then I have made two mistakes. Number one, I have placed a barrier between myself and God, the very same challenge that faced Abraham. The second mistake that I make is that I set myself up for a serious crash. Trust me, the day will come when that person in whom you have placed so much confidence, around which you have built your entire life, the day will come when that person is going to fail you. They're going to say or do something that is going to hurt you. Now, it may even be intentional or unintentional, but it's going to cut you deeply. They may even betray you in a way that will just kill you. And even if you can go through your entire life maintaining a very positive, happy, pleasant relationship with this person, there's a very real possibility that, guess what? That person is going to die. Then what? You've built your whole life around this person. And if that relationship is the most important, the most critical thing in your life, instead of God, then what happens to you then? You see, the problem that we often face in this life is that we make our relationships with people around us more important than God. Jesus addressed this in the Gospel of Luke. You'll recall that he issued a challenge to those who would be his disciples in Luke 14, verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Jesus, of course, is using the word hate here in the sense of to love less. I have to dethrone these people in my life, however dear and precious they are to us, and that's all perfectly valid, but I have to take them down a notch or two to make room for God at the top. And Jesus is saying, if you can't do that with these other people in your life, in your relationship with me, then he says, you can't be my disciple. Oh, you can wear the name, you can pretend, but it's not real. Jesus is not your Lord. If your whole life is wrapped up in some other individual here in this life. And so that can be our test. Who is really more important when it comes to relationships in this life? Is it God? Is it Jesus Christ? Or is it somebody else in my life around me? That's the test. How am I going to pass or deal with that test, that challenge that confronts me? Well, let's turn our attention now to another area of life, the second area, and that is that of our work or our career. The Bible tells us that work is a good thing. Paul wrote in Ephesians 4, verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer. Rather, let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. A man was placed upon this earth to work, to be busy, to accomplish something, to be productive. It's good that we work, that we have a career, that we spend our time effectively here in this life. The problem is, of course, that many of us allow our careers to become our God. We will sacrifice our faith, we will sacrifice our health, we will sacrifice our families, we'll sacrifice everything in order to be successful in that career. You've known people like that. Oh, they're very good at what they do. Very conscientious, very devoted, very dedicated. And they spend an inordinate amount of time in making sure that they are successful in their career. But in doing so, they effectively destroy everything else that should be part of their life, including, in some cases, their relationship with God. You see this in the book of Ecclesiastes. The author of Ecclesiastes, if indeed it was Solomon, was a man who spent a great deal of his life devoting his resources and time and talents toward work. If you look in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, we won't have the time to go through and look at all the details, but he goes through a long list of all these activities that he was involved in. And there was a lot of building, a lot of construction, a lot of just leaving his mark on this world. And the interesting thing that we notice when we get to the end of chapter 2 is how he finally, when he completed all of that work, he accomplished what he set out to accomplish in his career. He stepped back and looked at it. Notice what he said about it. In verse 18, I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And then in verse 22, he asked, for what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? This is a cry of desperation, of anguish, of emptiness. Here's a man who has made his career his God, and it ultimately proved futile. It was empty. He did not really accomplish or achieve or acquire that which he thought he would acquire by being successful in his work. We have to learn that no matter how successful we may be in our careers, our jobs, our work is not our ultimate purpose in this life. And if we make it so, the day will eventually come when we'll experience the same sense of loss and failure that Solomon experienced here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Oh, it's fun while we're working on it, but you know the day is coming when you're going to retire, when your health is going to fail and you can't work anymore, or the economy will crash and you'll lose your job and you're out on the street with everybody. Then what? If your job is everything to you, then when that test comes, are you ready to deal with it? But let's turn our attention now to a third element. And this one is closely related to the previous one. Some people work strictly for the joy of working. They just want to be busy. They have to be busy. Even if it doesn't pay anything, they've got to be working. What we're looking at here now with this third element is something that is related to that, and that is the material reward that work provides. And that's the money, the possessions that we get as a result of the hard work that we have been investing in. Now, let's be clear here. There's nothing inherently wrong about being rich. Money and physical possessions, these things are morally neutral. Having these things doesn't make us good or bad in and of themselves. You read in the Bible of many men, good, decent men, who are also very wealthy men. Their money did not necessarily make them or break them. That's not the problem. The problem is our attitude toward money. The threat is that by accumulating all of these goodies in life, that they tend to take over center stage. They tend to become the focal point of our life, the foundation of our security. Paul addressed this in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10, where he speaks of the love of money being the root of all kinds of evil. This verse is often misquoted. Paul never said, and nowhere does the Bible say, that money is the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all kinds of evil. Notice also in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5, where Paul specifically identifies covetousness, the inordinate greed or desire for money and possessions, he defines that as idolatry. You're putting something, some physical object, in place of God. That's idolatry. We would not even think, it's just so bizarre beyond the point of comprehension, that we today in our sophisticated society would bow down to a chunk of wood or stone or gold or something and call it our God, and yet people do it all the time with their bank accounts and their homes and their cars and investments and all these other things that in their minds define their success or failure in life. When money or possessions become the most important thing in our lives, then in fact we have made money our God. But notice that Jesus addressed this in a poignant parable in Luke chapter 12, verses 16 through 21, the story of the rich fool. The man whom God had blessed with abundant possessions, and in fact his crops were so bountiful that he said, I'm going to have to tear down my barns and build bigger barns to hold all that I have. And throughout that whole parable, and Jesus is quoting this man and how he's describing his status in life, you notice that all the emphasis is on himself. I, me, my, mine. Over and over again. Never mentions God. Never mentions other people and their needs. It's always himself. And finally, it reached the point where this man would say, you know, once he built his new barns, I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. He has arrived. He has achieved everything he set out to achieve by virtue of all the abundance of the good things that he surrounded himself with. But notice what God says to him in the next verse. Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? And you know, that's the thing, that in the midst of accumulating all of these things, it is so hard for us to stop and realize, this is temporary. I'm not going to have this stuff forever. I can lose it. It can be taken from me. Or at best, I'm going to have it right up to the day of my death, and then I have to leave it all behind. And somebody else gets it. And it's not going to do me a bit of good from that point on. All of the riches, the goods, the possessions that we surround ourselves with and in which we place so much confidence in this life, someday is going to fail us and we can't take it with us. And for many of us, we'll learn that lesson too late. If we're lucky, we'll learn it here in this life when we lose it in some great crash or disaster or something, and that's the test. God is testing us. What's more important? Me or your possessions? Me or your money? Me or your houses, your lands, your investments? We have to ask ourselves that question. And for many of us, we don't realize just what a bind we put ourselves in until we lose it all. But let's now turn to a fourth area in which God tests us, and that's in the area of entertainment or recreation. Now, recreational pursuits are quite appropriate in this life. We use the word recreation to describe these casual pastimes that we get involved in, apart from, separate from our work and the stress and the toil of daily life. We take a break from all that and we go out and get involved in recreation and entertainment, something to relax. The word recreation comes from a Latin word that means to recreate. It involves the idea of recovery or restoration of our physical and mental stability. We are re-energized to go back out into the workplace. And you see this throughout the Bible. Jesus took breaks. You know, on His ministry, the great earth-changing work that He was involved in. On more than one occasion, we read of Him telling His disciples, "Let's go away and rest for a while." They needed to take a break. It was important that they have some means of detaching from the pressure and the stress of the work that was upon them in order to rejuvenate their energy. The very first miracle that Jesus performed was at a wedding feast, a time of celebration. God even codified in the nation of Israel recreation in the form of the Sabbath day. On the seventh day, you shall do no work. You will take a break, or else. You had to rest. So, what we're saying here is, there's nothing wrong with entertainment. There's nothing wrong with recreation. That's all good and well. The problem is that these recreational pursuits can become our ultimate purpose to the point that they supplant all other interests in our lives. In 2 Timothy chapter 3 in verse 4, in fact, these opening verses of this chapter, Paul gives a list of the corrupt character of people that Timothy would likely face in his work. But one of the things stands out in this list of characteristics that relates to our topic here when he describes men as being lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. It's that contrast that holds our attention here. Nothing is wrong with pleasure per se. The problem is when we love that pleasure to the point that it crowds God out of the picture. We're lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Then we've got a problem. We have a new idol that is standing between us and God. Look at our society today. How many ways do people today make pleasure, recreation, entertainment their God? Parties, sports, hobbies, music, video games, exercise, television, movies, surfing the internet. We could go on and on. People, and especially in our society today, people have so much spare time and so much money to pursue pleasure and entertainment that it has, in many respects, become a god to people. When our pastimes become an obsession to us, and by that I mean it dominates our minds to the point that we can't think of anything else. The first thing we think of when we wake up in the morning is my hobby, my pursuit, my pastime, my fun. And the last thing I think of when I go to bed at night is the same thing. That's what I live for. When we reach that point in our lives, then we have an idol. Something that has separated us from God. And in the process of creating that idol, we are, in fact, setting ourselves up for a terrible disappointment. Now, you know, the day is going to come when we're going to lose these things, right? Once again, it may be because we've lost our health and no longer have the physical stamina to get involved in these things. We may lose the money that enables us to pursue these things as we would like. There are any number of things that can take these pastimes away from us. And when that happens, then what? What do we fall back on? If that has become our chief purpose in life, and we lose it, we become miserable. Life is no longer worth living at that point. Is that why we're here on this earth? What have we accomplished in pursuing all of these recreational activities? Again, doing these things in moderation is not a problem. Don't get me wrong here. But if it becomes the sole purpose of our life, we've made a terrible mistake, and the day will come when we're going to be put to the test, and we're going to have to answer what's more important, my recreation, my entertainment, or God. And that brings us then to the fifth and final area of life in which we are faced with a test. And this is going to leave some people scratching their heads, but hear me out. And that is our own moral goodness. Now, this makes no sense. I thought God wanted us to be moral. He wants us to be good and righteous and holy. Yeah, He does. But here, the threat is that our goodness can itself become a God substitute. Have you ever thought about that? Look at the story of Job in the Old Testament. Now, if you're familiar with the story, you know Job was a good man, decent man, God-fearing man. And in fact, if you look at Job chapter 31... in the midst of Job's complaints about all of the problems that have befallen him, in chapter 31, Job goes to this long list describing his personal character. All the good things that Job has tried to do in his life. And basically what he's doing there in that chapter, he's holding all of his goodness up before God and saying, God, where am I missing it? What am I lacking here? What have I done wrong that you've punished me in this way? You see what Job is doing there? He's in effect holding his goodness up before God and saying, this ought to be enough for you, God. And instead, Job was devastated to learn that his goodness did not earn him security and protection. You see, his tragedies were in fact his test. And you know, the irony here is that the one character in the book of Job that expressed this test more eloquently than any other character, including God, was none other than Satan himself. Look at what Satan said in chapter 1 and verse 9. He posed the question to God, does Job fear God for nothing? God were to rip everything away from Job, just destroying, crushing, would he still fear me? And in Job's mind, the connection between his wealth, his prosperity, his family, all the pleasant things that surrounded him in life, all that was connected to his character, his moral goodness. And so once all that stuff is taken away from him, in chapter 31, this is Job's cry to God, God, am I not good enough for you? And isn't that the same test that we face when life comes crashing down around us? Job was forced to look deep in his heart. He had to decide why he was being good. It wasn't just enough that he be good, but why was he good? It gets back to Satan's question here. Does he fear God for nothing? If all this stuff were taken away from him, would he still fear God? And that was a question that Job was forced to wrestle with. His goodness was not in order to earn something. You don't earn anything from God. How many times do we have to be reminded of that? And my goodness, my righteousness, my holiness, whatever I might achieve in this life in trying to lift my character up, it does not get me to first base with God. I can't earn it before God. Job couldn't earn it. He was good not in order to earn something from God, but in answering Job's question, he was good simply because he loved God. And that's the test that we have to face. When things come crashing down around us, why are we good? Why do I knock myself out to resist temptation, to be a good person, and do all the things that God wants me to do? If my intent, if my purpose, if my goal in being a good person is in order to prove to God and to those around me what a fine, upstanding person I am, I have an idol. My goodness is my idol. And it's not until I have my life ripped out from under me that I am forced, like Job, to face the question, will I serve God for nothing other than the fact that I just love Him and I trust Him to do what's right? So look at these five areas of life. Every one of us, to one extent or another, touch these five areas to one extent or another. And the question that we have to pose to ourselves in each one of these areas is, are these more important than God in my life? Have I allowed any part of these things to intrude into my life to such an extent that I have, in fact, kind of shoved God aside? He's no longer all that important to me. Well, how do I prepare for these tests? Paul gives us a good hint in 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. He said, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? Don't wait until God has to lay the test on you to find out what you're made of. Paul says, do this every day to yourself. Examine yourself. Look at those five elements in your life. And each day ask yourself, are any of these things more important to me than God? Is there any area of my life in which something of this world, even though it's good and it's innocent, it's beginning to intrude into my heart, into my life, to such an extent that I find God being slowly shoved aside? And if you'll apply that test to yourself every day, then you can catch these problems before they become catastrophes in your life. You know that Jesus followed that path. He tested Himself every day throughout His ministry. How do you think He managed to stay strong through all of the ridicule and the hardships and the privation that He had to experience in His work? So that when the time came that He had to face the ultimate test, He was prepared for it. And you remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, He had a choice. He could call on legions of angels to swoop down and rescue Him from the horrible, gruesome death that He knew that awaited Him. Or He could hold firm, stay to the course that was before Him, and do what His Father wanted Him to do. And, of course, we know what His decision was. Lord, take this cup from me. Not my will, but Yours be done. And He went to His death doing His Father's will. He passed His test. Because He lived His life daily facing a test. And that's what each one of us has to do. What is your relationship to God this morning? you see yourself drifting away? Are you having a hard time holding on to your faith? Then look at these five areas in your life and see what's there that is holding you back, that's erected a barrier between you and God. And look to the example of your Savior for the way that you need to test yourself, examine yourself every day, and purge your heart, your life, of those things that would stand between you and God. If you need to respond this morning to the Lord's invitation, we're here to help you, to assist you in any way that we can. We encourage you to come forward and express your need as we stand and sing.
When we walk with the Lord in the light of His Word, what a glory He sheds on our way. While we do His good will, He abides with us still, and with all who will trust and obey. Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust. But to trust them.